Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
And so you have to understand that vision. And for me, I moved to California to understand that vision. You can't just work at a dorm room and Chicago and then with your parents in Jacksonville and then, you know, on the road all the time and really internalize what the Golfers Journal is. So I moved out there and spent, you know, 3 years learning that and building my filter.
Hello, Tie friends. Always a treat to have you here with us. If you're listening for the first time, welcome. Get comfortable, sip on that bean water, put your feet up, plug in those headphones, whatever feels right. Today, I am joined by Casey Bannon, assistant editor at the Golfers Journal and the Swiss Army knife of an operation that delivers those beautiful copies to you once a quarter. My interest in Casey's story comes from several different angles. He was convicted of his path towards media and journalism early in life, has put in the work, and the work is good. That's an interest. He speaks and is spoken of in this very honest and genuine manner. It's not impossible to find, but it's unusual for someone his age with so many eyes and ears attuned to what he puts out. That's an interest. He's a great golfer who's married to a great golfer. His father is a great golfer, and there's much more where that came from. That's an interest. And lastly, I'm 25, curious about building a brand that brings value to you and satisfies my creative spirit, our creative spirits. We want to continue to move through the golf world and use that to better ourselves and the people around us. That's what's being done at the Golfers Journal, and that's an interest. It's always a treat to sit down with another podcaster. There's something about it that is difficult to replicate. If you haven't already, go check out Casey's Mind Game podcast to learn more. Thanks for coming. Thanks for staying. My name is Walker Simas, and you are listening to the Tie Podcast with Casey Bannon.
It's a pleasure to finally meet another one of my internet friends.
That's right.
First time on a live podcast.
Podcaster to podcaster. It's going to be fun. I always love talking to podcasters. And you're much more than that. We'll get into that later. Before we dive deep into the depths here, it is obligatory. We must head straight for the dirt. Casey Bannon, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking recently?
This is starting off with just a smashing question. I've been drinking a lot of water, or trying to. I do enjoy a good red at night. A good red in my price range. So those two things and coffee are pretty much what makes up most of the fluid in my body. Reading, I am chipping away at the Elon Musk biography that Walter Isaacson just came out with. I love Walter Isaacson. He's a phenomenal, phenomenal reporter. And I just, I like the way that he just tells kind of biographical stories in a very linear, sort of straightforward way. It's like comfort reading because I don't have to think too hard. It's just you know, the story from A to Z. So that's been fun. It's like 670 pages or something. So I've just been kind of chipping away at it. What was the other one? Eating. I've been on a pretty good barbecue run, actually, Walker. I did. Sunday, I went to practice at the Yards, and then me and my lady went to Valley Smoke, which is right behind TPC Sawgrass, and it was just outstanding. The brunch there is outstanding. And then I went and saw my parents on Sunday, paid Mama a visit, and Mom made ribs, so that was a pleasant surprise. And then Monday, I was up in Sea Island, and you have to stop by Southern Soul, so that was like 3 days in a row. Of just
a great, you know, weekend.
I hit the triple crown, I think, really, of pulled pork and ribs.
What's your vibe? Are you like you into brisket, pulled pork, smoked chicken, wings?
You know, I was a brisket guy and a ribs guy, and lately I just want a pulled pork plate. I don't know what that says, whether I'm getting really like kind of conservative in my late 20s. But that's all I want. And I want cornbread and I want slaw and I want beans. And I want to try the different sauce. Valley Smoke had this Alabama white sauce that just, you know, knocked my golf shorts off. It was really solid. So barbecue. What was the last one?
Thinking. And it can be.
Well, that's a tough one. That's a.
You got a lot on your mind.
Yeah, I mean, most of my thought is devoted to, like, you know, how to tell better stories at, you know, at my job, how to be better at my job, how to make better products, how to create a better experience. That takes up a lot of bandwidth. Obviously, there's some stuff in the world right now that also took up some bandwidth this week, you know, with sort of conflict. And so I was doing a lot of reading and listening this week, trying to really educate myself on how we got to that point, and like what it means for the rest of the world. But, you know, there's a lot of thoughts going on, but most of it, I would say, is dedicated to the Golfers Journal and like trying to create a better product.
Very well said. I struggle with this often because, you know, we're a golf podcast and you are completely familiar with this because, you know, when you're putting out stuff, you've got an audience that expects stuff to kind of be in a certain lane. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, like, as a human, you get warped into certain readings or stuff that people are talking about or worldly events. And it's important to have a good set of buddies and people you can discuss stuff out with, because it can be challenging knowing like where to air that stuff out and where to have dialogue. And but I appreciate you airing it. It's very real.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, great ideas come through sort of like good conversation and multiple voices adding to it. I think it's my favorite part of the job is the of discovery, where you have sort of a half-baked idea and then you throw it to somebody else and they, you know, take it down a different it forks and it goes down a different path, and then you build that triggers something in you and you build on top of it. Mm-hmm. So that's like those moments are what I kind of live for as far as like staying in your own lane or being bound to a lane. That I think that's the, you know, that is the struggle for anyone that puts anything out into the world and has any sort of audience. You know, they are, you're catering to them, but you're also, as an individual and someone who wants to be creative or who is creative,
yes,
you're constantly being influenced, right? Mm-hmm. And that influence spills into what you give the audience, and then the audience gives you feedback, and you know, it's like this constant tension of what I want to make and what people want to consume. So, and I'm kind of going through that. I go through that all the time, you know, and there's my thinking on that, I think, has really evolved in the last couple of years. I was when I first started doing this and putting things out into the public space, whether, you know, 100 people were consuming it or 500,000, I was really of the mindset that, like, I don't want to be too influenced by what other people in this space were doing. Like, I want my ideas to be my ideas, and I don't want to fall into the trap of, mm-hmm. you know, doing a bad impression of somebody else. You could think like that. Now I'm of the belief that, like, everything you put out is sort of the sum total of everything that you consume, right? So, like, everything that you read, everything that you watch, everything that you hear, all the discussions you have sort of blend together, and it influences your ideas. So the more that I think you have to you should consume a lot, and that's where better ideas come from and better things come from.
I agree wholeheartedly. You've been doing this for how long? I mean, when you graduated college, I know that you were doing work for the Golfers Journal when you were still in school. But how long have you been iterating on creative ideas and pushing that out into the public?
Probably. So I got hired when I was actually in grad school. So I played college golf and I graduated and I mo immediately moved up to Boston to work for the New England Sports Network, for the which the Red Sox own. It's their TV channel, their television channel there. And I was in the marketing communications department, and my goal was to go from there, do a year, and then move into the editorial room and be a writer there. And the way that they're just set up, just the corporate structure, it became very obvious after a few months that that wasn't going to happen for a long time. So I sort of left after maybe 6 or 7 months. But even then, I was like, writing commercial spots for them and doing creative things. I was blogging about the Patriots up there for a free USA Today site called Patriots Wire. I took a NESN press pass and I went to Patriots training camp. It was like a camera. It was like a camera assistant pass, and like sat in the front row and would ask Belichick a question that he didn't like, and then I wrote a piece on it about Kenny Moore, who I was right at the time. He did end up making the roster, but Belichick didn't want to talk about him. Anyway, long story short, like I was always trying to break into media somehow. So I left there and I went to work for a small startup in DC called DMVstream.com, and we had a production truck, and we would go around DC, Maryland, Virginia, broadcasting the game of the week there: high school basketball, high school football, high school lacrosse. And then on Thursdays, we had a studio built, and we would come in and we produce a show, a web show, where we would, act as pundits and talk about the reporting, and Stephon Diggs' little brother is going to be the guy, like all these things. And I had no idea what I was talking about lacrosse, but so I was staying active in that field, and then I got into Northwestern Journalism School, did that, and yeah, like with a few months to go in my schooling, I had pitched the Golfers Journal. The Golfers Journal popped up. I thought it was just, I loved everything about it. I loved the subscription model. I loved the aesthetic. I loved the sort of editorial storytelling. I pitched them a story. It got accepted. And then that was it. I sort of wiped my hands and like kept going off in my thing in Chicago. And then they, Travis, our editor, called me and offered me an internship. And that was 4 years ago. So almost five. So it's been 5 years of doing this at the Golfers Journal now. And it's been kind of a whirlwind. I mean, it went from 0 to 100 kind of overnight.
So this fall, 2023, will be Golfers Journal number 25, if I'm correct.
Yeah, 25
And
is 25 is out. Yep, 25 is out. So it's been 25 issues, yeah.
looking back, whether it's your Grammy moment or whatever else, like when you have that flashback moment of all the memories cooped up in the office, on the road, sleeping at subscribers' houses. Late night chats with Foster or Hafer or whoever else, like what is the memory train look like when you think about, man, I started and I was so young and was trying to figure these things out, and now we're here and we still feel just as urgent to move forward and carve a new path. How would you describe the last 5 years or so?
Oh, I mean, it's a fantastic question. I don't really know. It's been a blur, and every sort of 2 years, every year or 2 years, I'll sit down and like write a letter to myself to read the next year or the year before that. And I'll
It's
go
a good
back
idea.
and those jog my memory of what the hell I did. The memory that comes to mind is sort of January of 2020. And I'm sitting in, we have a meeting. And Brendan, who founded the Golfers Journal, comes in. He's like, I think we should build a sprinter van and take it on the road and do events. And the sprinter van will have, X, Y, and Z. It'll have, a pop-up shop in it and a recording space and whatever. And it'll be blacked out and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, and I'm only like a year into the job. And I'm like, that sounds cool. Like, yeah, definitely we should do that. Not thinking that's going to happen. And then he's like, yeah, it should be on the road by Masters week, so in 3 months. So we have to find a van, kit it out, gut it, rebuild it all the way. And then he comes in the next week. He's like, I bought a van and we're doing this. And then the question becomes, well, who's going to drive this thing around the country? And I'm looking around. I'm like, okay, they have kids. Like they have, and everyone's just staring at me. And so, at 24, whatever it was, 25, yeah, 24, 25, they stuck me in the van. Now, during COVID, like at the peak of COVID in that summer, I took the van and went out for like 60, I don't know, it was 2 months plus. And the van is too tall to go through drive-through windows. It's over, 9 foot, whatever. All of the inside of the restaurants are closed because of COVID. So I either have to walk through the Chick-fil-A line or I have to survive off Nature Valley bars in the van. And so like I lost 20 pounds. I didn't sleep. I met some of my best friends through Twitter DMs and Instagram DMs and random pop-ups at golf courses. I would ask them if I could stay the night, nine holes after meeting them. And that just kind of summarizes, I think, the experience of working here, which is like we take big swings and we go and do immediately and you figure it out as you go. And just like everyone else, we're iterating and learning and figuring it out and, trying to think differently and do cool, different stuff. So that would be those are the memory. That's the memory that just, kind of boggles my mind.
I mean, that's the thing that I think we can all relate to in some regard, and the big advantage to having a young, sporty, ambitious team is like, it's really not that hard to have those like crazy big swing ideas, but it actually is such a testament to you all at how consistently you like do what you're saying you're going to do and follow through on those ideas, because that is the only thing that moves the ball forward. So I commend you for that. I mean, that, it's like the vision, black van on the road. Well, yeah. Black van was on the road and it has been, and it still is. And that's awesome. Transitioning, if I'm correct, your dad's a retired Blackhawk pilot, former collegiate golfer. You've got three sisters. I'm sure he was just thrilled that you ended up becoming a golfer. What was growing up like?
Wow. It was great. He was a Blackhawk pilot, special forces guy. Tough guy, always got the job done. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was in charge of, he took 305 or something soldiers into combat in Iraq a couple times, never lost a guy. He was a man of his word. So obviously that filters down. We moved a lot. We kind of always came back to Northern Virginia, but he did a year at the War College in Newport, and then we went to Savannah, Georgia for 3 years. And then we came back to Alexandria, Virginia twice. So moving was difficult, making friends and losing friends is difficult. Having three sisters is great now. Having three sisters then, when your dad's gone, for a year on deployment, tricky, So my mom stuck me in every sport you could think of, played a ton of baseball, like because they played the most games and it took the longest. Yeah. It was a great learning experience. I got to sample a lot of the country, I think, a lot of different people. I got to sample what it's like to live in the South and be from the South and what their customs and traditions are. And in Northern Virginia, I lived where I graduated high school and spent my last sort of 6 years there. I lived in a neighborhood with people from West Africa and Honduras and and Korea, and my high school was super diverse. So, if you can get past the friend thing and the instability, I think it was a great, great, great childhood and exposed me to a lot of different things and a lot of different ideas and people.
It's got to be hard. Like I remember being a kid, and I have a very similar experience minus moving around a whole lot. I have two sisters, and, when you're young, because it's all, you have this belief that like, I really need to hold on to my friends because this is who I've got. But it's hard to see past that and realize that, no, man, you can make friends your whole life. And if you get the reps in early, which you kind of were forced into, you know, making friends for life is similar to being a lifelong learner. Like, it's just something that you continue to do.
It is getting harder, though, I think. And there are, you know, there's numbers that say that, you know, in the 1980s, I think it was like 4% of men reported that they did not have 3 or 4% reported they did not have a single close friend that they could call on, you know, at any given time. And that number's up nowadays closer to 50% for young people, you know, 20 to, I forget what exactly what the demographic is, but it's, you know, probably that 20 to 38 sort of range, 18 to 38. And that's pretty scary, you know, and I notice it too. It's kind of hard to make friends. Most of my friends, pretty much all, I can only think of one really close friend I have that did not come from the game of golf. But you know, you can make friends later in life. It gets harder and harder if you're not exposing yourself to new things, or if you don't, like, I work from home now, so I'm not at office where I'm making new friends. But like, Foster's a great example. Foster, during that van trip, sent me an Instagram DM, said he was going to meet me in the parking lot at Pinehurst. I pulled up, this kid's waiting in a Georgetown sweatshirt. I'd never met him before in my life. Exchanged 3 messages with him. 10 minutes later, we were best friends, you know?
And he was at your wedding.
He was at my wedding. That night, he stayed in our hotel room, slept on the floor. Like, so when lifelong friends are amazing because it's instant, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really instant. It's not work. But yeah, you know, finding those are rare, and you really got to cherish them and kind of put work into them.
You make a good point, and I to a degree take back what I said. I think we all know the reason why it can be more and more challenging, just thinking from when I grew up, to make really meaningful friendships. Like, I mean, it's almost a non-negotiable today to be very much online, to be consuming a lot. I think about what you said in your thinking, like what we put out is quite literally the sum of what you're consuming. And fortunately and unfortunately, you're going to be consuming a lot. The question is, what are you consuming? Golf. I mean, the whole reason kind of for this podcast is, yeah, like I like golf and Henry likes golf, but it kind of takes on the role of some sort of vehicle where, like, how many friends do you meet inside, you know, you know, just getting outside and hanging out with people. Golf is a really good vehicle to do that. And that's where the good stuff is made. So okay. I want to talk about school. So St. Leo, as we were talking before we started recording, not many people know what San Antonio, Florida is. What was your dad's story? How did he make it to St. Leo? And I'm sure that kind of turned into your desire to go to school there.
I avoided it for a long time, actually, but I can save that for later. He grew up in, he's from Rhode Island, and he had a really good player on his high school team. They won states. They were 1-2 on the team. St. Leo recruited the number one kid and then saw my dad and said, I guess you could come too. And then they had never seen St. Leo. They showed up to San Antonio, Florida when it was orange groves, you know, sight unseen. And they played on the golf team. After their freshman year, the school cut the program. So my dad had no way to pay for school, and the ROTC approached him and offered to pay for his school if he joined that. So that's how he found the Army. And then when he was a senior, he was a resident RA there at St. Leo and saw this blonde girl on a freshman parking her bike on orientation day. And then, you know, that became my mom. So both of them went there. And because of that, I always said, I'm not going there. I mean, I'd never even visited before, but I had played a tournament down in, I had played the Optimist International Tournament at West Palm at PGA National, and the St. Leo coach was there. And I wanted to play Division I golf. And I went and took my what I thought was my last recruiting trip to University of Rhode Island. Did the whole thing, loved it. They've got so many great golf courses up there. I was willing to bear the cold to play for them and be around my dad's family. And he said, why don't you just take the visit down to St. Leo and just go see it? And this was December and it was 27 degrees in Rhode Island. It was 81 in Tampa. And once I saw it and the golf course, you know, you can literally walk out of the dorm onto 36 holes at Lake Jovita. And I changed my mind. And it was the best decision I ever made. It was a place where you could go and compete 12 months a year. And we did. Like, there was not, we got 2 weeks off for Thanksgiving. The rest was qualifying, you know, qualifying rounds, tournament conditions every day. And it made me a much better player. And we ended up like assembling a great team of international kids and, you know, last chance U types and, you know, winning a Division II national championship against some pretty good teams. So,
yeah. And I heard you had a great, great squad there. I know it's never perfect, but being a part of a team and competing, especially in school, especially when the weather's warm, it's as good as it gets. I was checking out your profile on St. Leo, and you know how most of those like profiles are just horrendous. You know, yeah. Like they do the little bio, you know, before you get to school, and then they do kind of a yearly report. And I was reading yours and I was like, shit, man, he got a lot right. Like, started off, hobbies include tweeting fine foods, playing basketball and watching movies. Nailed it. Career goal is to win the national championship. Check in the box. Did it. And then I guess to conclude here, chose St. Leo because of the opportunity to reach his full potential. It begs the question, what has changed when you ended up writing that as a senior in high school or whatever? What's different now? What's the vision? And how is that different now than when you wrote it?
I guess the only thing is I don't like tweeting anymore. I don't really like posting anything online. Really, if I didn't have to, felt like I didn't have to for work, I wouldn't, you know, no one would ever hear from me. But at the time I was really big into it and it got me in, you know, some hot water at school often, but I loved it. Not much has changed. I knew exactly what I wanted to do always when I got there. And I always knew that I wanted to get into this media game for whatever reason. I really don't know. Like, I just knew I wanted to tell stories. When I was at St. Leo, I had to get an internship. So I begged the athletic communications office for an internship and they gave me one. And I ended up broadcasting, doing play-by-play for seven of the school sports teams there. And I just wasn't any good at it, didn't know anything about field hockey or volleyball, but I just knew, like, I just knew I had to sharpen something, you know, and get reps on a microphone. And so that's funny. I haven't read that profile. Don't look at that profile, by the way, because every year I would do it different.
It's a sweet picture, too.
I was going to say, like, I was doing the Jimmy Butler way before him. So, like, my junior one, I grew out of the mullet and I had the mustache and, like, the chain. And then the senior year, I had some girls dye my hair and my beard, like, jet black the night before. I don't know what look I was going for, but I definitely regret that now because it's on the internet.
It looked like a mugshot, but it was, like, it was killer. It was badass.
I appreciate it.
So, tell me about Medill. What was it like going to school? Obviously, you know, you just spoke on it, wanted to get reps in, kind of knew that this is what you wanted to do, but why grad school? Like, was that, did it feel like a necessary step or did it feel like something you maybe weren't completely sure about, but chose to do anyway?
Yeah. So the ecosystem at the time of media, and still to this day, it's probably gotten worse, was that, you know, it's kind of like these, you hear like people applying for jobs, then they need 2 years experience for the job, but they can't get experience because they don't have a job. That's right. What journalism was at that time. It's like, where are your clips? You know, clips as in like writing samples, like where have you been published? You know, what have you been on? What have you produced? And it's like, well, nobody will give me a chance. Like, no, nobody. I emailed every single newspaper editor on the East Coast. I have no's from every single one of them saved in my inbox. How am I supposed to do this? Well, I needed some sort of weight attached to my name. And when I was in seventh grade, I won a raffle to go to a live taping of Pardon the Interruption in DC. And me and my dad went, and Michael Wilbon stayed with us for 2 hours after talking. And he said, if you want to get into this game, you got to go to Northwestern. And that had always kind of stuck with me. So I took a shot. It was a bad, numbers wise, it's a bad investment. You know, you're taking on student loans, you're going back to school, you're paying essentially for the clout, the name, the brand name recognition backing of Northwestern and their alumni network. But I think it's the only reason that Travis Hill at the Golfers Journal opened my email. So, like, you know, all square, I guess. But it was tough. Like, J.A. Donde was my academic advisor there. He ran the sports journalism department. Melissa Isaacson, who covered the 95 Bulls up until Jordan left, was my other professor. And they just put you through the ringer. You know, they'd send you assignments at midnight. You know, like flash warning, flash drill, fire drill, you know, do at 5 p.m. And you're walking around in the snow of Chicago, sticking microphones in people's faces, learning how to report. So
is that just the culture?
Yeah, they're just trying to make tough, hard-nosed reporters. And I think it's getting harder and harder because a lot of us that have been on, that grew up in the iPhone age and in the social media age, we've lost a little bit of the art of, you know, the in-person walk up, you know, the Riz,
contact,
I guess
sport.
Call it. Yeah. Yeah. And that they would throw you in every situation possible to make you uncomfortable and beat it out of you until you were fine doing it, you know, and it's helped tremendously. The other thing they did was like their 2F policy. So one time I spelled Southside of Chicago with a capital S. That was an automatic F. The next one I had like a factual error, or maybe it was a typo, 2 F's, you know, you get the third F, you fail the class, and then I got to pay for another semester. So, you know, factual being, you know, accuracy, you know, real accurate reporting, typos, all that stuff was just not tolerated. And it gave me a much better toolkit going into the workforce than I think some others didn't have.
So obviously that is like purposefully difficult, but, you know, having some time away from that experience, what were the key takeaways? In other words, you know, before you went to grad school, you were absent this. And when you left grad school, I had this. What were those things?
I think it's just I knew how to write when I left. I thought I knew how to write and I thought I was a good writer, but I learned a ton of sort of story devices and techniques and leads. And my writing got much tighter and much more clear. And I learned how to write for, you know, short spaces, traditional news articles. I learned how to write long form magazine. I learned how to write scripts for television, which I now use in our video sort of short films department. So I learned how to write. I learned how to write narrative podcasts. Like I just learned how to write and in a variety of environments, and everything comes back to opening a Google Doc or wherever you prefer to do your writing and putting words on it. So that was the main thing I got out of there.
What does your creative process look like? And I know that that is a really broad question because you do cover many, many facets within the Golfers Journal, but maybe a better way to ask this question is, how has your creative process developed over the last 4 to 5 years? Like, what do you find yourself routinely doing that keeps you in check, you know, produces good results, things of that nature?
I was much more manic at the start. I think they would be ideas would come spilling out. It would be hard for me to think. I think it was detrimental to my health, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like it was just a nonstop sort of like fire hose of ideas and thoughts, and a lot of them weren't that great. And so I built a filter, first and foremost, for those. and you build a filter by, you know, adapting to the culture that you work at. So they got, my ideas got much more focused. And then I kind of felt like I plateaued a little bit and got into maybe a more like conveyor belt templated system where I had done this thing this way before. And now I can keep doing that. And I had to break that. It's something you always have to break, I think. And so now it's always evolving, I guess. A long answer is it's always evolving, and you have to have some sort of self-awareness to know like that you're not in a creative space. And so you need to go do something to creative to free it up. I do much more, most of my creative thinking now in the morning. I used to do it at night. I used to be a late night guy. Now I'm an early morning guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from 5:30 to 8:30 is where the ideas come. And then they come in the shower, and then they come as I'm vacuuming. So, I need to change the environment or do something else, just do something to let those ideas flow and really work at driving is another good one. So you see a trend there where it's like, I'm not like in front of my keyboard forcing it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
But there's no, you know, there's no one fits all solution to this. Sometimes, a lot of the times, it's having breakfast with Travis, you know, for 3 hours and just talking in circles, and then you find it, right? Like, I, you know, shell of an idea, like, build on top, and right. Then boom, now you have a breakthrough. Now it could go a bunch of different ways. So
can you help me understand that filter? Like, I love the concept, but to get more granular, you're telling me that you're spitting out a bunch of these ideas, whether they're in your head or on paper or whatever else, and it's too much. So you need to filter some out. How do you physically do that?
It's something you have to build internally. I did take a stab a few weeks ago at writing out what I thought the filter is in the context of the Golfer's Journal, like what my filter actually is, like what are the pillars of something that makes it pass the filter as being a good idea. And I never really finished it. I don't think it's like quite ready for, you know, a company-wide memo, but right. You know, it's, there are sort of like key checkpoints, right? Like, so one, is it a good story? Like, does it tell a good story? Two, does it provide value to our members? Three, does it have potential for growth? Like Steve Jobs talked about three stools, you know, three legs on a stool. Like, is that just sort of like a good idea in a vacuum, or does that thing have potential to break out in a bunch of different ways? You could go as far as saying, does this have potential to make money? It's not really in my filter day to day sometimes, but not really. If that's the factor that like causes you to pursue something, I think that's probably a bad idea. So those are the types of things that like, and also it's just like culturally, you know, like we're following a vision that Brendan Thomas set at the beginning when he started this thing. Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand that vision. And for me, I moved to California to understand that vision. You can't just work at a dorm room in Chicago and then with your parents in Jacksonville and then, you know, on the road all the time and really internalize what the Golfer's Journal is. So I moved out there and spent, you know, 3 years learning that and building my filter. And so now I can make better, more efficient decisions on a daily basis.
That's a great answer. So there are a couple things that I want to ask simultaneously. I hate it when this happens. The first is I want to do one more question regarding creativity, and that is, you know, you have your own personal creativity, which is one thing. Like, you know, Casey gets down and he writes, or you've got a project that you want to pursue, but you're at that stage where you don't really have to involve anybody yet. Like, it's Casey's idea. You get to flush it out and other people can see it later. But with your job, you're also responsible, and you've set up this life where information passes, you know, through you, around you, like constantly, whether you want it or not. You're going to get a lot of information, a lot of stories, a lot of to-dos. What is the difference between your own creative process and like taking in all these ideas and filtering it down into, you know, it's not just a product, like it's not just the book, it's also the events and everything else. But what are the key differences there?
That's a tough question. I think you just have to understand, you have to keep your, you know, you have to constantly be evolving and growing with the brand that you're working for, or the company that you're working for. So part of my job is to understand where are we at in this stage? How are we evolving? How do we want the tone to evolve? How do we want our voice to evolve? How do we want to present ourselves in the world? And I think a lot of that dictates what is the most important thing at this time. You know, another great Steve Jobism is like, focus is not saying yes, focus is saying no. And that is one thing that has been the fight of my life for the past 4 years, because there's so many great ideas. Everyone has great ideas. And there's so many things you could do with the Golfer's Journal. Like, there's so many things that within the community, within the event space, within apparel, within physical spaces, within, you know, like global clubhouses, like you like within magazines, within books, within content, like you can go, like, it's just a lot, right? And you have to say, like, okay, what is the thing? What is the most impactful thing I can do for the next hour? What is the most impactful thing I can do today? What's the most impactful thing I can do this week? What is the most impactful thing I can do this year? And then 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, right? And it's never perfect. And this is like something I work on a lot with everyone that works here. It's like, you feel that tension of like, I should be doing more because there are so many great ideas, but the pieces, the chips will stack up if you do your job over the next hour and then you do it over the day, like that compounds, and you'll find yourself, it has like it's been it's a tunnel vision thing, right? Like when you ask me the question about like, what are the memories of the last, like I have to think about it, because it, to me sitting here today, it feels like I've accomplished nothing, you know, yes, so far. It feels like I've done absolutely nothing to warrant you even asking me to come on the Tie podcast.
Right.
But you look back and you're like, oh yeah, that was pretty cool. That was good. So yeah, it's a tough one. You really have to make hard choices, and you have to get selfish and picky with your time. And you also have to stay on top of a lot of different shit. Right. And have faith in the decision that this thing I'm working on is the best I can do right now, and hope that over time it's enough, right?
Yeah. Well, you answered about three other questions that I had in one answer, so thanks for that.
Of course.
I guess the last question that I have regarding the responsibility that you and everybody else at the Golfer's Journal feels towards your subscribers and your members.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, you have a million things you want to get done. Those got to be filtered into the things that are most important. But are there any beliefs or kind of long-term goals that you guys really held on to for a long time, thinking, man, you know, we're working really hard on this and we're not seeing the results. I don't know if this is really ever going to come to fruition. And then it ended up happening. Like, I struggle with this all the time, where, you know, you're pursuing something that you're focused on for a year and a half, 2 years, and maybe you're getting marginally closer to that thing, but sometimes it feels like you're never going to get there. Have you guys had something like that?
Yeah, all the time. I would say the one that might be the best example of that is the Golfer's Journal podcast. Like, I, within a few weeks of me starting, like a space opened up, and there was like, you know, you produce this podcast now, like, meet Tom Coyne, you produce it. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. Like what is our show? You know, who is Tom? No, I knew who Tom was, but like what do I do here? And for about 2.5 years, 3 years of me doing it, I tried everything in between to try to get people to listen to it, you know, and tried to find an identity. And it was finally when, like, I was about to give up on, like, doing content in general, I think, you know, I was like really wanted, I was like, I'm just going to move into like the business development space, or like sort of a behind the scenes role. And like, you know, the events are crushing and I'll do that. And I'll like, you know, work more on the community side or the merchandise side or whatever. Like, we decided to simplify and like just do great long form interviews with surprising people or people that could go really deep on one thing. And when we focused it and we stuck to a very simple formula, I mean, the numbers went up like a hockey stick, and they've continued to go up. And that was the first time that I really believed that I could like make, help produce content or be a part of it or be like an editorial person. And that happens more than you think in a lot of different areas, you know, sending, doing any type of content work. Like we have an art director named Tom Brown, who's great. And he's got a ton of experience and he's just kind of a legend in the space. And I was asking for his opinion on like this graphic template that we were using. And I called him and he said, well, why are you calling me? And I said, well, I want your opinion on this thing. I'm bored by it. Like, I think it sucks. And he's like, have you gotten positive feedback on it? And I said, no. And he said, have you gotten negative feedback on it? I said, no. And he's like, oh man, I'm really sorry. And I was like, why? And he's like, that, you know, no feedback will drive somebody insane. And, you know, when you're making physical magazines that go out, there's no like, yeah, you get nice emails. And when you go see people at events and stuff, that's where you get all your feedback. But you just mail that thing out there and then you just make another one, you know? And so you really have to go out into the world and seek feedback. And Discord has been a great sort of way to sort of like break the barrier down and get sort of immediate feedback as well. But you're not, I don't know if creators are getting as much feedback as people think they do, or at least mm-hmm. I don't as much as I'd like, you know?
Yes.
And that's a difficult space to be in because you don't know what, you know, how things are going really.
That's a good point. I agree with that. It's hard to get feedback and you gotta want it.
Yeah.
Curious about podcasting because it is a completely different medium and we've kind of flip-flopped here. And you've done way more podcasting than I have, but in my short life, you know, started with audio and, you know, attempting to write for the first time. And, you know, you wrote for the majority of your young career and then got into podcasting. When you started to have some of those conversations, has there ever been a guest or somebody who you've talked to who just like seriously warped your understanding of a topic or changed your view on something or just said something where you went, holy shit, and thought about it in the shower that night and thought about it the next morning that you woke up. Has there been something like that?
Oh, wow. At the Golfers Journal or anything?
Yes. Although I could extend that question out further because you're out and about so much and you talk to so many of your members and I think that question could extend well past interviews.
There's been a few I can recall offhand. I was just up at Newport Country Club with Tom and we were playing in this match play tournament. And after the first round, a gentleman came over and said, like, dude, I love your podcast. I love the Golfers Journal, blah, blah, blah. And it was so cool because no one had ever said that to me before and kind of in person. And we got to talking and he's a professor at Duke and he teaches like consumer behavior psychology. And he was talking about how he's developing this sort of scale to measure responsiveness to failure within people. And through this scale, he could tell you whether the game of golf is good for you or not good for you. And his thesis is that golf is not good for everyone, even though he loves it. And that one, you know, twisted my brain all up. I spent the next 3 days like talking to this guy, like the only person I met at this tournament. I was fascinated, but that was one. We've had
really good.
Yeah. When I was at Northwestern, I went to go do a story on Jackson Park, the golf course on the south side that Tiger Woods and Bo Welling have been trying to redo. It's this famous historical, you know, predominantly black golf course. The Obamas got married there at the Cultural Center. And Tiger's had plans to do this thing for like 5 years. It's tied up in litigation and just classic Chicago. And I went down there to do a story on it. And I met a gentleman named Craig Bowen, who was the first black employee at Acushnet. He was hired in 1991 to start recruiting Tiger Woods by Wally Uline. And I talked with him for an hour for that piece. And then I ended up scrapping the piece and turning it into my master's thesis and turned it into 10,000 words about the sort of like the small, very small things along the way that led us from 12 black professional golfers in the 1970s to two today, or one or two, you know. And they were small things, you know, like gas cart. Bigger, you build bigger golf courses around real estate development. Well, you can't walk anymore, so you build gas carts. People take carts. You don't need caddies. Caddies were the primary way for black people at that time to, you know, gain, you know, access to golf courses, and also it was sort of the gateway into the game. And then you just sort of keep on climbing up that ladder. And he really transformed the way that I understood golf history, but also American history.
Wow.
So it happens all the time.
I've thought about golf carts a lot, but never in that regard. And that's a really interesting thought piece there.
Yeah.
I may have to go in and read your master's thesis.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah, please do.
There's some interesting stuff in there.
Going back to creativity to some respect, I'm interested what you feel like you were innately gifted with and what things you had to work and iterate on really hard to be good at, and maybe some examples of things within the Golfer's Journal or your young career where you're like, man, I've tried, but I'm not real good at this. And we've got to find somebody who loves this so that I don't have to do this anymore. What are those three things like?
So I've always felt like I knew how to spin a good story. And I always loved talking to older people and listening to older people when I was younger. All my friends were older. I love talking to my parents' friends, and they had some great storytellers come around. So I love weaving a good yarn and getting the timing right, you know? So that was like, I think, the raw skill that I then had to learn how to tailor to whatever it is I'm doing. If you have that skill, I think you can do a lot in this game. I had to work really hard when I joined the Golfer's Journal on developing my eye and developing a sense of aesthetic and design, because it is so crucial to the company. And I knew if I really wanted to work there, I had to understand what made a good image, a powerful image, and also how it works in space, and also how it works in harmony with font, you know, typeface, mm-hmm. and a larger layout, and then across all the different platforms. So that education is still ongoing, but I would say I spent my first year looking at photos and poring over the past issues and talking to the photo team and asking the art director questions about why this here, like why this, what makes that good. And I also memorized every single Google Drive pathway in the Golfer's Journal so I could be of assistance of some kind. So I know I basically have a recall of every single image that the Golfer's Journal has in its archive to this day. So every single photo that comes in, I look at, file it away mentally, and I can tell you where it's stored. So that was like the thing that I worked really hard at, and it became useful, very useful at my job. The third question that you asked is probably social media. That was my first job there, and I can get you part of the way there. But I really do not speak the language of social media, nor do I feel comfortable trying it, you know? So I can tell you what pictures to post and what, you know, this cut of that and this edit is good and that stuff like that. But people that are really good at social media, I think, really have a gift of being able to tell stories in creative ways or just like speak this language of that particular platform that they're on. So I would rather, and I still work on it from time to time, but I would, everyone knows that I'm just like, dude, I'm not the guy for this.
Great answer. I struggle with social as well because it's a necessary evil to a degree, and it's not always evil. Like some of the great, I always talk to people about this. Like I've gotten nearly, I don't know, 75-80% of my jobs and my career through Instagram. And it's like, that's, you can't look over that. Like you'll Instagram a lot.
No, and, you can't. That's the tough thing about it, man. Like it produces so much good. It produces so much good and can lead you down some really interesting roads, but it just don't have the discipline to use it for only that good, you know?
Right.
And that's the problem.
Yeah. I got to hold back my, you know, every now and then I want to like throw a couple memes up or something irresponsible and need to create a side page. Something that you've talked about a lot on other podcasts and really enjoyed some of the other podcasts that you've been on, is increasing your surface area for luck. And I'm curious, kind of as we close out the bulk of the episode today, there are things that like you're doing right now that are increasing your surface area of luck that you just can't. It's like I read Rick Rubin's book earlier this year, and one thing he talks about a lot and believes in heavily is like you can't know. You just can't. So there's no point. You just need to learn how to have a better relationship with yourself and iterate and do what you feel is right. But there are things that you did in the past that increased your surface area of luck, and you've been able to kind of see those develop and can look back and see patterns and themes. What were some of those key things early that, you know, you put your head down and worked hard because it felt like the right thing to do, but ended up creating some really nice pathways for you?
Yeah, I think all of it. I think, you know, broadcasting games in college, I think taking that job for no money in DC, you know, getting $50 a game to go like cut highlights for the Washington Post before 11 p.m. when the game ended at 10 and you live 45 minutes away. Like doing that in McDonald's parking lots, you know, in your car or inside, you know, deciding to be the beat reporter for Evanston High School, even though it's like the red line and the purple line and a lot of snow in between you every day. Like you just have to have faith. Like it felt like I had to do that. Like it was never like a choice of like, I don't want to do this. It was like, you have to do this because that surface area for luck increases every time you decide to get on the train. Like every time you say yes to a job, you know, and when you're said no to a lot, I think that that's part of the driving force. But I also think that if you're really motivated by something and driven by something and have this gut feeling, like deep down inside you, there's no other path for you, then that stuff's not really that hard in the moment. Like I look back and it was like, it wasn't really, it sucked like at times, but like it also felt like I was just, you know, being groomed or just taking my licks, you know, and doing it. But like, you know, each one of those, absolutely, I believe, is a flywheel and leads into one another, and then just increases the probability of a good bounce going your way. And that's all it is. You need one bounce. I got a good bounce. There's no other secret to it. Like, I got a good bounce. I was there at the right time as a new publication was starting. I had a story to tell. The guy was in a good mood. He opened my email. And then after that, it's all work, you know, after luck just comes work. And, but yeah, to answer your question, like if you're a young kid and you want to do anything, like say yes to everything, just go full in, just say yes to everything, take every opportunity, even if you can't see how the dots connect, like they will end up connecting.
Casey, some quick hits, and we'll get you out of here. Here we go. If you could only follow one team for the rest of your life, who would it be?
Follow one team?
Follow one team. You're a big Boston, New England sports guy. You got to pick one.
Like cover them or just watch them?
No, just be a fan. You've got to throw all the others out. Can't watch any games. You got to pick one.
Patriots. I mean, I'm really, the Patriots. Football Sundays are, there's nothing better in the world. And I'm really glad we're getting our, I'm really glad we're bad this year. It feels like, I feel deserving. Like, I feel like I need this feeling. I needed this feeling to enjoy the successes again.
Yeah, it's a good take. In three words or less, moving across the country to California was what?
Really fucking expensive.
Just chef's kiss there. If you were forced into a singular role at the Golfer Journal, you could only focus on one niche task, and you got to assemble all the other time and the effort and the drive that you put into other things and dedicate it towards that one task, maybe for a year, what would it be?
I would probably podcast. I would probably do this.
Mind game.
Yeah, I would mind game it.
One person you haven't played golf with but really want to.
Wow. Harry Styles.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
Harry Styles. Happiest you've ever felt on a golf course. Where, with who, and why? It's a tough question. It's a really tough question.
A good question. I feel like I could build a magazine out of that question. Just ask it to everyone. Happiest I've ever been on a golf course.
We've all got a moment.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. I would say I was playing with my dad and two of my uncles at Army Navy Fairfax when I was in high school, and I had 220 out of a bunker, and I hit a Tommy Armour 3 hybrid that plugged about 3 inches away from the cup, and I was probably an 11 handicap at this time. And I think about that shot all the time, and I still have that club, and in many ways it was the first time I thought I could actually play golf. Like, that was
that'll keep you coming back.
It came out of the center, dude. Like, it was,
I don't know if I can hit anything 220 anymore.
I did not think it was getting there, but yeah, it was the best golf shot I ever had.
Did you have a lip to compete with or no?
I did, yeah. I mean, it was, yeah. I have no idea how I did that, but Tommy Armour made a solid little 3 hybrid back in the day.
Yeah, McGregor's underrated. Dunlop. There's some good shit out there.
McGregor's high class.
You're going to love this one. Nipsey Hussle or Outkast? I feel like I already know this answer.
So easy. That's so easy. Nipsey Hussle. Yeah. I've got him on my wall right here.
Yeah. Is what it is.
Yeah.
Two more. Would you consider yourself more of a fixer or more of a perfectionist?
A fixer. Yeah, ask you can ask my wife that too. She said the same thing.
All right. To conclude our podcast, dream guest on Mind Game. This is like potential manifesting situation right here.
Probably Obama, and not for political reasons. I've just heard like, well, one would do very well for the numbers. But I've heard some really good Obama golf stories that I'd like to have on record. Like
It's a good
really good.
take.
Like
I'd
really
love
good.
to interview him.
Yeah. That or Larry David, I think, would be really just must listen podcasting. So, and I hope to get there one day.
It's really good. I hope you do. I think you will. Casey, thank you for joining me today. Really enjoyed the chat. Look forward to more. And best of luck, seriously.
Thank you. I'm sorry about being so long-winded, but I was excited to talk with you.
This
So,
is a podcast, dude. Long-winded's where we live, man.